This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery life right now? I sometimes find myself feeling a little drained after meeting up with groups of people, even my best friends. I can't quite put my finger on why that is. I know I didn't always feel that way, but it can be easy sometimes to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves too thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. Dialing in and finding the right balance is going to be different for each person, whether you're somebody who thrives around people or if you prefer more alone time. Either way, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Therapy is not just for people who've experienced major traumas. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills, how to set boundaries, and it empowers you to be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, and the service is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a quick questionnaire that will match you up with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/filmdaily today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/filmdaily. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for Friday, March 17th, 2023. On today's episode of the show, I'm going to be joined by somebody to talk about all the stuff that he's seen at South by Southwest 2023. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Jacob, happy St. Patrick's Day to you. We're actually recording this one day early, but happy St. Patrick's Day in advance.
I'm recording this from bed on painkillers. On my way home from South by Southwest the other day, I hit a deer at 70 miles an hour on the highway. My car is wrecked. My body is not great. And if I sound like I'm in pain throughout this podcast, I apologize.
Well, yeah. So I want to talk to you about what you've been doing at South by Southwest. I hope everything else that you've been doing there has been a little bit more safe than that. So obviously, well wishes, speedy recovery to you. But tell me about the movies and shows and stuff that you've been seeing. What is your favorite thing that you've seen?
Well, this is not a complete list of everything I've seen. I decided a few things that aren't really especially noteworthy or interesting, I'm going to leave off this list. And also, I'm focusing mostly on the major stuff that I saw. If you want, like the smaller discoveries and like the movies that aren't, you know, come to a theater near you, you should go on to slashfilm.com and check out the reviews from Rafael Montemayor and Aaron Brady, who've been hitting that beat. I've been thinking of all the big world premieres. And I'll start with, I think, probably the biggest movie that played at South by Southwest. It wasn't even formally announced. It was a quote-unquote surprise screening that was not a surprise at all by the day it was playing. But it was John Wick Chapter 4 ahead of its release next week, had its North American premiere at South By. And Ben, I feel like you and I have not talked to John Wick enough. How much of a John Wick fan are you?
I really love the first movie, like the second movie a lot. The third movie, it kind of pummeled me into submission. I feel like I was starting to lose a little bit of the magic of this franchise on the third movie. But from what I've heard so far, the fourth one is pretty kick-ass. So I'm hoping that it's going to, right the ship for me.
Well, fourth movie, the rumors are true, it's 3 hours long. but I will say this much, it has more action in it than I think most movies have in their running times. It is pretty much nonstop. I think there are three action scenes in this movie, and each one of them is, minimum like 20 minutes long, with the final hour being one long action scene. I guess the spoiler free way to tease it would be one of my writers who was at the same screen as I was pitched it as, this is John Wick reenacting Sisyphus's, story in Greek mythology, to give you an idea of how wild it is. John Wick Chapter 4 is in the press. Chad Stahelski, the director, said that they're kind of taking a break after this one, and this feels like them trying to be like, yep, let's get the people they want on the biggest scale possible and step away from the John Wick universe for a bit. It is, it's wild. And I will say, I felt its length until I didn't, because once that final hour kicks in, I can't believe I'm saying final hour of a John Wick movie. I felt like all of everything I was perturbed about, even slightly, kind of washed away, because the action staging in this movie is extraordinary. And in that final stretch, I just don't know how they did it, man. I don't know how they did the scenes they did. And we have interviews with the director on Slash Film, upcoming interview with the stunt coordinator. And even after reading those, I'm like, man, I'm not so sure how they did this? There are shots and moments and stunts, or I don't know how people died. Like, to paraphrase Steven Soderbergh from a few years ago, he said that he watched Mad Max Fury Road and does not know how George Miller made it. And I imagine that unless you're Chris McQuarrie, who did the Mission Impossible movies, the most recent ones, I don't think he watched John Wick 4 as a filmmaker and then, like, sleep that night because just the anxiety dreams of wondering how they did this are just holding, are like really, like, standing out to me. Anyway, this is my long-winded way of saying that it kicks a whole lot of ass. And there are action beats in this movie that I think we'll be talking about for a bit. And the variety of the action, I mean, like, just when you think, like, this action is going on maybe a little, maybe it's actually about to go on too long, they change locations or they change rooms or a different type of bad guy shows up or the weapons get swapped out. Just like that final gauntlet of action scenes, for example, you know, it just goes from location to location, from place to place, and it keeps up in the ante of who John is facing and why he's facing them. And I just, man, I watch a Fast and Furious movie, and I enjoy it, but I always say, oh, yeah, okay, they put Vin Diesel in a car from a green screen. I don't know how they did this one. I don't know what they did. I don't know how you safely make John Wick 4's final hour and walk away without somebody being dead. I don't know how, Ben. I don't know.
Yeah, I had a similar reaction that I was talking to BJ on a recent episode of this podcast about the first time that I watched Police Story 3, and that movie ends with just a spectacular series of action sequences where they actually are doing stuff probably in a super unsafe way, you know, in that sort of Hong Kong cinema of the 80s and 90s era where they actually were like really dangling off of the edge of buildings and like doing stuff where people broke bones and all of that. So I'm guessing things are like a little bit more controlled in the 2022-2023 era filming of a John Wick movie, but man, I'm excited to see this after that ringing endorsement from you.
Yeah, I mean, people have smart things to say to me. Like I said, a couple days after seeing it, what stands out is just the visceral experience of the action and how Chad Stahelski utilizes his stunt team, how he utilizes Keanu Reeves, you know, who's still at his best here, and how, like, when people do need to talk, when, like, the movie does slow down, the delve into its, you know, increasingly, you know, complex world building of the high table in the criminal underworld, like, at this point, it's practically Dune. It's practically Lord of the Rings. It's no longer in our world. It's a criminal fantasy. That's kind of why I like it.
But like, well, speaking of things that aren't necessarily in our world, the next movie that you wanted to talk about is also a sort of a big budget fantasy in a way.
Oh yeah, it's a big budget fantasy in every way. It's a Dungeons and Dragons: Honor Among Thieves, which was the opening night film itself by, and it was the world premiere. And Ben, would you believe it when I said that Dungeons and Dragons: Honor Among Thieves is the most complete feeling studio blockbuster of this type of genre that I've seen in some time?
The only reason that I would believe it, well, there are two reasons. One, you said it, so I put some stock into your opinion. But also, because it's made by the guys who made Game Night, the trailer for this movie looks abysmal to me, personally. Like, it does not look funny, it does not look interesting, but from what I've heard, the reaction to this one is pretty strong. So I'm guessing this is one of those cases of, you know, the trailer being as broad as possible in an attempt to bring in the most people as possible, but the movie itself has a little bit more personality than the trailer leads you on to believe.
You know how every Marvel movie of the past few years and every, like, in so many major studio movies, they get to the third act and you start getting disappointed and it falls apart. You realize it's probably because they started filming without a finished script.
Yep.
What if I told you that Dungeons and Dragons: Honor Among Thieves has an airtight screenplay with character arcs, setups, and payoffs, and a third act that concludes the emotional journey of every member of the cast, and that the directors, the writers and directors they directed Game Night, they co-wrote the screenplay and directed this. What if I told you that their script feels finished in a way that most studio movies don't these days?
That sounds very, very nice and genuinely refreshing, so I'm thrilled to hear that.
Anyway, Dungeons and Dragons is an extremely funny movie. Every character is funny. They do so without the expense of their world. Like, you know how Marvel, especially recent Marvel, seems embarrassed by their characters? Like I like Quantumania. I'm the rare person who likes Quantumania, but that movie was super, like, MODOK, ha ha ha, what a dumb name. And characters in those movies are always, like, sort of, like, making fun of their world to try to, like, be above it and try to ward off criticism in advance. Mm-hmm. Dungeons and Dragons doesn't do that. It's very, very funny, but the characters are all honest about their world, and they never make fun of their world. It just, it's ridiculous and silly, but never, and it's never embarrassed by it. It's very, very happy to be a fantasy story, Ben. And so refreshing. I didn't know how much I missed this.
What a concept. What a concept. How is Chris Pine in it? That's a big question.
Chris Pine as Chris Pineius. This is a, he is incredibly funny. His character is the charming, sarcastic rogue of the group. He's a former spy who's fallen to a criminal lifestyle. And he sings. He gets to wisecrack everybody. He gets to have, you know, his big, but also has big emotional moments. He's a character who, the movie is built around his character's arc and his quest to win back the love of his daughter, which is a point where I say, Ben, I thought I was crazy until I talked to some people who also agreed with this, but this really does play like the big action-y blockbuster version of Princess Bride in terms of tone.
Wow, okay. That's high praise.
And I love Princess Bride, and I guess because Princess Bride, the movie is really, really about families and about love and connection, and even though this movie is a big, you know, silly action movie full of, you know, big sequences and much bigger than Princess Bride ever was, I walked away feeling like this is very Princess Bride to me. And I think people are going to make fun of me. I think people will see it and like snark at me saying, of course, it's not like Princess Bride. But I would watch these two movies together. And I think that there's an emotional honesty to both that I think pays off. And also, this is very, very important. There are CGI monsters, Ben. But if it's even remotely human-sized, it's a guy in a suit or a puppet.
And that's oh, that's cool.
So one of the very first things you see in the movie, I guess the opening scene in the movie, is Chris Pine and Michelle Rodriguez's characters in prison getting ready to make their appeal to the parole board to be let out of fantasy jail. And the parole board is one human, one halfling, a.k.a. a hobbit, created with, visual effects, one guy and one like dragonborn, which is like a dragon shaped human. It was like literally a guy in a Jim Henson-esque puppet. Like he has dialogue and he talks in a scene, and it's like 5 minutes of the movie I was like, oh, they have a practical dragonborn in this Dungeons and Dragons movie. I think I'm gonna like this. And the answer for the rest of the movie was yes, I did.
Fantastic. All right, what did you think about Evil Dead Rise? That was the one that premiered last night as we're recording this.
Yes, Evil Dead Rise, it's the most Evil Dead movie, Ben. Are you a fan of the Evil Dead movies?
I've seen the first two, and I've yet to see Army of Darkness, so I don't know what that says about my fandom.
Yeah, this one is, in terms of its intensity, closer to Fede Alvarez's remake, 2013. That movie was incredibly violent, if you remember it, for folks at home remember it. It's like unrelentingly gory and upsetting and hostile to the audience. Lee Cronin, the director of this one, writer-director of this one, he produced a movie called The Hole in the Ground, which I really liked, but it was a very quiet, kind of low-key, you know, creepy movie. Goes in the opposite direction here, where this movie is as violent and as intense and as unrelenting as Evil Dead Remake, but it's actually fun. It's actually kind of like in on the joke, and like instead of trying to pummel you into submission, it's more about creating things so outrageous you kind of have to laugh. And of course, the big change up here is that it's the first Evil Dead movie that's not, you know, set in the wilderness or in case of Army of Darkness in the distant past, and it is about a family who reads from the wrong curse book in a Los Angeles apartment, and things go horribly wrong. And the movie always has this kind of nasty edge to it because it's not just a bunch of horny college students in a cabin who are hacking each other up. It's a family. It is a mother and mother's sister and three kids of various ages. And so by default, the movie is like feels transgressive in that way because it's family against family as people get literally hacked to pieces and horrible things are shouted in demonic voices, and this gooey, gooey, gooiness. If you go to horror movies or Evil Dead movies hoping for the most violence or the most gore or the gnarliest creature effects, this will deliver. It is, once it gets rolling, it's pretty much nonstop in that department. It is, whoo boy, there are effects, you're like, Ben, they're clearly using a lot of the practical, you know, visual effects for the various dismemberments and mutilations and whatnot. But there are certain effects where I'm like, there has to be digital effects here. There has to be like a marriage of digital and practical in this shot because there's literally no way to do this safely without that. So as a piece of filmmaking craft, as like a 90-minute like tour through hell on earth, essentially, where you're invited to laugh at the hell on earth, This movie is extremely fun. Like, I don't think it's particularly deep, but also I don't think any Evil Dead movie is deep. I think the Raimi movies were an excuse for Sam Raimi to, you know, have a series of set pieces of things that he clearly wanted to film and goof off and lean into what he found, you know, interesting or funny or intense. And Lee Cronin here, I think, does the same. It's just a, I'm not going to say turn off your brain, because that's never a good advice for me. But I think that there's no depth here, but there doesn't need to be. It's just an excuse to admire the horror craft on display, and I really enjoyed it.
Okay, so that's Evil Dead Rise. All of these movies that you've mentioned so far are coming to theaters pretty soon, like within a month, I think. So definitely stay tuned for those. I guess before we go any further, let's take a quick break, and then we'll be right back. All right, Jacob, you've also had a chance to watch a couple of TV shows, right?
Yeah, I saw the world premiere of the first few episodes of Mrs. Davis, which is the new Peacock show that's co-created by David Lindelof, although the showrunner is Tara Hernandez. But it's funny about the show because it feels like it's playing in David Lindelof's his playground of ideas, like things that interest him, faith versus science, mystery boxes, human connection. But Tara Hernandez, I think, is the wild card here. I think there is a very goofy comedy streak to this show, this science fiction show. If you've seen the trailer for it, it kind of hints at that. But there's real Lonely Island and real Monty Python energy on top of all the normal Lindelof stuff. The way I described it in my review is that it's like Lonely Island adapting Neal Stephenson, the very brainy science fiction writer. So I don't know how, like, but also, like, there's a little bit of Preacher in there. There's a little bit of early Kurt Vonnegut. There's a surprising amount of The Leftovers, David Lindelof's previous show they made for HBO. But like, it's like if The Leftovers was a Looney Tunes episode. it's really something else. The premise is that it's alternate 2023. There's a all-powerful artificial intelligence called Mrs. Davis that has supplanted Facebook, supplanted social media. Everybody wears an earpiece where Mrs. Davis tells them what they need to know, tells them how to live a happy life, how to get what they want. And the main character is a nun living in Reno, Nevada, played by Betty Gilpin from GLOW, who refuses to talk to Mrs. Davis, who refuses to get the earpiece and refuses to engage with her. And she gets roped into a quest that I will not spoil here. I'm not sure the trailer does, so I won't say it here because it's a really fun reveal. She's roped into a quest where she's working for and against Mrs. Davis at the same time to try to serve and destroy the all-powerful AI that dominates the world. And the show is kind of chaos. It kind of does not tell you information until you need to know it. It kind of doles out its mysteries at its own pace. And it's extremely goofy. There is a motorcycle chase in episode one that it might as well be a live-action Simpsons sequence. I think some people are going to be turned off by how chaotic Mrs. Davis is and how it really is just trying to be a show about everything. It's trying to meld, extremely low comedy with, high-minded satire about AI and where we are now. And it's trying to be a show about faith and about how we grapple with faith, but also a show that's about goofy magician stuff. There's a shocking amount of magician subplots. And few episodes, especially the reveal at the end of episode two, which is, like I said, I would love to talk to, I know we have an interview with Hernandez and Lindelof coming up soon on the site. I'm not sure if this will not be addressed on those interviews, because interviews are spoiler free, but the conclusion of episode two, the moment that made me realize, yeah, I'll have to get Peacock and watch the rest of Mrs. Davis, is the, most David Lindelof. I feel like it had to be like a David Lindelof concept because it feels like a very natural extension of both Lost and Leftovers. So that's Mrs. Davis. You may hate it, but I like the chaos.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. I'm a big David Lindelof fan. The one question I have about it, Jacob, is like, you mentioned Preacher as being like a potential inspiration or something. Is the show preachy, though, is my question, because like with the idea of AI versus everybody else, or versus this nun character, and like everyone in the world sort of buying into this AI concept and this one lone figure standing in opposition to that, there's a danger there of it feeling like the people making the show telling us, hey, don't spend all day looking at your phones, which is like something that, you know, a message that people have tried to convey before, but it just feels like out of touch in a way, because it's like it's not possible anymore. Like we're so far beyond that as like an observation to make, that it feels, you know, reductive almost when people tell stories where that's like the main theme. So I'm curious if there's more to it than that as the sort of underlying message.
I think so, because I never got a turn off your phone message from Mrs. Davis. I got a the show is less about turn off your phone and more about what do you value in your human existence. Like because Mrs. Davis as a concept is essentially a fascistic force. Mm-hmm. The way the show lays out how it controls people and how it makes you happy while also taking away any semblance of freedom you think you have is less about social media and phones and more about political awareness and more about, you know, how you value yourself as a person or how you choose to read into faith. And mm-hmm. the faith aspect, I'm not a religious person, but I found episode 2's exploration of Betty Gilpin's character's faith to be kind of profoundly moving. And that was a subplot that made me realize that I was in. So I think that it's a very, very modern show. It's tackling lots of modern ideas, but I never got a put down your phone, millennial. You know, what are you doing?
Okay.
Gen Z. And I never got that from the show. At least from the episode.
That's good to hear. All right. You also had a chance to watch some of Rabbit Hole, the new Kiefer Sutherland spy show. Is it a spy? Is he playing a spy in this?
He's playing spy adjacent. This is a new Paramount Plus show. I saw the first 2 episodes, and I watched it because I'm a big fan. I was a big fan of 24 back in the day. I love Kiefer Sutherland on TV. I think he's on his element on TV where he's yelling and pushing people against walls and growling at them. And he does a lot of that in this show. I was hoping for a pretty good dad show, a show, you know, similar to Reacher or Jack Ryan, you know, Bosch. I was hoping for something along those lines, you know, a traditional throwback, something you watch with your dad or your father-in-law, and you both like nod and say, yeah, that was some cool tough guy shit. And Rabbit Hole at first fulfills that. The basic premise is that Kiefer Sutherland is he's a freelance espionage agent who works for white-collar organizations. Like if you want to manipulate the stock of another company, or you want to create an event to cause people to sell off or make major financial decisions, him and his team will sort of create false realities. They will create fake news reports or create the illusion of something happening on the streets where it's not actually happening, using technology and spycraft and acting and, you know, body doubles and just timing. And the idea is, and at first it feels like a pretty typical CBS-esque procedural. You know, it's a Paramount Plus show. CBS made it for Paramount Plus. And at first, I feel like, oh, it's going to be a show about Kiefer Sutherland's character's team as they go about, you know, creating white-collar crimes while the FBI looks into him. But pretty early on in the episode, they kind of blow his character's life apart. He's suddenly without his team, used out his resources, he's on the run, and he's framed for a crime he didn't commit. The FBI's on his tail. But then episode 1 ends with a very peculiar reveal. And episode 2 began immediately at South by Southwest. So I was able to sort of, you know, lean into what happens next. And the show starts getting weird from there, and weird in a good way. It starts revealing that the premise of the show and everything you saw in episode 1 was from a very specific perspective. Kiefer Sutherland's character was keeping things from us. Everything he has not told you or told, everything he's told us, you know, it could be a half-truth or a lie. There are characters who are discovering things about his situation that don't line up with what the show has presented before. And the Rabbit Hole title feels very literal, because by episode 2, you started like being let in layer by layer by layer as the show pulls you deeper into a much bigger conspiracy, a much more labyrinthine plot. What you thought was this simple CBS procedural clearly has a lot of truly deranged moving parts. And episode 2 ends with the character reveal. And an actor reveal that I thought was incredibly fun and definitely gets the biggest pop from the audience as you realize who the character was and its role in the show. And that character also kind of redefines the nature of everything that happened in the first two episodes. So yes, it's a very good dad show. It's a very good Kiefer Sutherland roughs people up show and does cool spy shit show. But I was really impressed by how the show is clearly unfolding deeper and deeper toward a mystery where each episode is kind of rewriting what you saw before and revealing that every character in the show is a damn liar and every one of them has more than they're letting on. And I found the first two episodes to be very fun dad-tainment.
All right. I mean, it's not surprising to hear you describe it that way when you realize that the people who make this show are, I think their names are John Requa and Glenn Ficarra, who are the people behind that movie Focus with Will Smith and Margot Robbie, which is like a con man movie from, 2015 or something around there. That was like very labyrinthine and lots of twists on twists on twists and double crosses and all that kind of stuff. So it sounds like they're taking that idea and just applying it to that kind of dad show template that you're talking about. So
I was surprised anybody by how much I enjoyed this. Like I said, I'm already kind of diehard on Paramount Plus. I think their library is actually one of the best in streaming. So when this hits Paramount Plus, I will be watching the rest of it. And so that's take from that what you will.
All right. So you also had a chance to get back into some more movies. You watched a horror movie that played, I think, at Sundance earlier this year called Talk to Me.
Yeah, we have a review of this from Chris on the site, and I disagree with Chris. He gave it a pretty middling review, whereas this to me was the scariest movie since Hereditary.
Wow.
It freaked me out. A24 bought this. It's hitting theaters this summer. It's the rare A24 horror movie that has a pace to it. Like I love A24. I love the slow burn stuff, but this is a A24 horror movie. It's fast. It's down to business. It's scary as hell. I made my skin crawl. And I think Chris took issue with the characters in a pretty major way, but I really didn't. I think they kind of acted like realistic teenagers. The premise here of this film is that this group of kids, they're Australian. It's Australian filmmakers. I've come into possession of a embalmed hand that lets them talk to the dead. You hold the hand, and you can start seeing ghosts around you. You can invite the ghosts to take over your body. And they hold parties where kids take turns letting ghosts possess them because it gives them a high. It feels great. It's wild. People have a great time. They film each other. And it's essentially irresponsible kids being irresponsible. And naturally, things go very, very wrong when the wrong ghost goes to the wrong person for too long. From there, it's... I know saying my nerves were shredded is a cliche, and I hate saying it, but Ben, my nerves were shredded by Talk to Me. I was... This movie is a feature debut from guys who have made like music videos and like YouTube channel stuff. But you wouldn't know it. It looks so, it's so well made. It's definitely an Ari Aster level debut in terms of this guy's first movie or these guys' first movie. I said, it's not surprising at all that A24 leaped on this. I think this is going to be like, it's punching the same weight class as Babadook and The Witch and all those other A24 movies. Or Babadook, wow. It's in that same like heart in your throat. Oh my God, what am I watching? Gnarly, just horror movies. So, yeah, I respect Chris, but I disagree with his review and think that you should absolutely have Talk to Me on your radar. I think July is when A24 is releasing it.
Yeah, that sounds right. Okay. Yeah, I was planning to, maybe not skip this one, but at least see what the conversation was. But I guess between... very curious to see what happens here. You also watched Late Night with the Devil. I've not heard anything about this one. What's this?
This was a world premiere. It's a very small movie. This is a movie that was pretty much made for me. It's a found footage horror movie that presents itself as a long lost episode of a 1977 late night talk show. And this episode, it's being presented as being like, hey, here, like literally there's Michael Ironside plays a narrator who says that the tape you're about to see is real. Here's the background on this TV show and its host before this final episode aired. And, what you're about to see is real, et cetera. And then the episode/movie properly begins. And it's, a 90-minute, late-night talk show in the Johnny Carson mold, except that it's a show that's kind of failing. It's not that funny. We really can't get good guests. And other than the commercial breaks, it cuts to, behind-the-scenes footage that for some reason is being filmed. You kind of have to suspend your disbelief there of the cast and crew scrambling to get their show made and, snipping at each other and trying to figure out how to get the ratings up. Ultimately, it's a Halloween special. It's that year's Halloween special. And one of the guests is a doctor and the girl she claims is possessed by the devil. And as the title Late Night with the Devil implies, things go pretty bad for this late night talk show as things spiral out of control. David Dasmalchian plays the host here, and this is going to be the year of David Dasmalchian, Ben, because he has this movie, which he's really, really, like, he's really convincing as a talk show host, as a guy who would be funny and charming enough to host a talk show. But he's also just, like, he brings, like, real emotional depth later on. And this is a guy, if you don't recognize the name, he was in, he was Polka Dot Man in the Suicide Squad, James Gunn's movie. And he's also been, like, you know, he's been popping up everywhere recently.
He was like the deranged looking dude in The Dark Knight that dresses in the police outfit.
And he has this movie. He has a Stephen King adaptation, The Boogeyman. And he has Last Voyage of the Demeter later this year as well. So this is the year.
I think he was the voice of the that sort of like ooze creature in Quantumania.
Yes, he was. Yeah. So, yeah, he's blowing up. And he is really good here. He's the anchor that holds the movie down. The movie is really well built around him. Like, even though the movie looks a little digital, I think the cinematography is a little too digital. The Foley look like it's a complete artifact. The production design, the costume design, the acting is really all on point. It feels really, really convincing as a fake talk show for the most part. And watching how it spirals out of control and watching how it ends up playing with the found footage format. There's a chunk near the end where it does something with the concept of how we view found footage in a way that I've never seen a horror movie do before. That's incredibly spoilery, so I'm not going to talk about it. But it does stuff that impressed me. And I'm a found footage defender. I watch so many bad found footage movies hoping to find a good one. And I don't know if anybody listening has seen Ghostwatch, the BBC TV movie that cast actual BBC anchors and pretended to be a investigation into a haunted house, but was actually scripted. This would make a great double feature with Ghostwatch. I think that I say less people running through woods while people shake trees and more exacting recreations of TV specials where bad things happen. And I'm the kind of guy who I love that the first 40 minutes of this movie is just a late night talk show for the most part with a handful of spooky parts. I love that you're kind of forced to endure the bad monologue and like watch as they try to make this TV show and like sort of ease into the 70s setting before things go wrong. If this sounds appealing to you, then yeah, you'll probably like it. If you listen to this description and say, what should I keep going on about? Then not for you. But Late Night with the Devil is extremely fun and really interesting. And David Dasmalchian rules. And I'm really hoping Shudder or somebody picks it up soon, because I can't imagine this being a movie that sits, you know, unbought for too much longer.
Okay, so the next thing that you saw is Flamin' Hot, which I think is directed by Ava Longoria. Is that right?
Look, I'm leaving out most movies from this podcast I did not enjoy. I'm talking about things I really liked. That's why I've been so positive on this episode. Is I'm not talking about things I didn't like. But I feel like I should address Flamin' Hot. So it's a world premiere. It's hitting Hulu from Searchlight Pictures later this summer. It's a major movie. It is Eva Longoria's feature directorial debut. And I have an ethical problem with this movie, Ben. I want to bring it up to you because I want to know if you think I'm crazy about this.
Okay.
Flamin' Hot is the story of the guy who... his story is that he invented the Flamin' Hot Cheeto. He said that he was working as a janitor at Frito-Lay, and he invented the spice that they put on Cheetos, and that's now everywhere. The Flamin' Hot brand is a $1 billion brand. And he spent the last 10 years doing speaking tours, talking about how he invented it, how he pulled his family out of like near poverty, how he became a self-made, successful branding executive at Frito-Lay because he understood that Hispanic and Latino Americans wanted snacks that appealed to their tastes. But the problem is, and the LA Times has a massive article about this I'll link to in my review, is that this is all bunk. He made all of this up. The team that developed the Flamin' Hot Cheeto developed it years before he had his job, before he claims he did. He did work on other products at Frito-Lay that were Hispanic and Latino-oriented, but he did not work in Flamin' Hot. And the largely retired team who did make the Flamin' Hot Cheeto, which was a team of people, not one guy, they did not realize that he was going around doing speaking engagements, taking credit for their work. And when they found out, Frito-Lay conducted a massive investigation, concluded that it was all false, that he had nothing to do with it. And the LA Times wrote this all up, like Frito-Lay is... gone out and said, this is all fake. LA Times has all the receipts from everybody who worked on the project, all the dates, all the times. And Frito-Lay informed this production before it started filming that, hey, LA Times has this story. This story is not true. You should be aware of this. They filmed it anyway. It's presented as fact. And even has like the typical biopic closing images of like of like the guy in real life photos, you know, here's what he did now and here's where he went. So it presents an utter fabrication from a con man as truth. It never once tries to like act like we're adapting a fairy tale, we're adapting an urban legend, we're adapting a falsehood. It elevates this guy as being the real person who did all this when he straight up did not, and the filmmakers were informed that he did not. So that's one problem. The big problem I have with the movie, Ben. So is this question of ethics? Should it supplant the movie itself? If the movie is good, should this ethical concern derail that? That's my question for you.
I feel like if the movie is good, then that's just a really important companion piece conversation that needs to be attached to every discussion of the movie, because that seems to completely undercut, you know, what the movie is purporting to say. But if the movie is good, then I think there are, you know, obviously there have been plenty of movies that take tons of liberties with the truth that are incredible movies that stand on their own, Social Network, Wolf of Wall Street, whatever. Like, these movies are not exactly how things went down, but they're amazing movies. So it is possible for something to take such liberty that it results in a good movie, and it almost like doesn't matter in the same way. But is the movie any good, Jacob?
No.
Ah. Okay. That makes it really difficult to justify. Then,
look, I'll say as much. The audience seemed to eat it up. It's designed to be a crowd pleaser, but it's a biopic that leans into every biopic cliche, except it's about Cheetos instead of a more exciting accomplishment. And I say that somebody who really enjoys spicy Cheetos. The issue with it is that everybody has their heart in the right place. It's a movie that's about Mexican Americans and how the tastes of Mexican Americans fundamentally shifted. The American market, like Flamin' Hot Cheetos, were developed because people are getting more interested in that type of food, the food that was, you know, non-white, like people from Latin America and Mexico. And the movie's very, very proud. The movie's incredibly proud that Mexican Americans, Latinos, Hispanics fundamentally shifted how food is made in America. And that's a really cool thing. And it actually is like a powerful point to make. But the movie literally pauses every 5 minutes for a character to monologue about it. There's not a point where it lets you like ease into it. There's not a point where it lets that be a revelation that you have as a person. Mm. Everybody essentially turns to the camera and says it out loud. And there's constant voiceover narration that says it again and again and again. It's a movie that's built around, I'm going to steal a quote from, I'll start talking to somebody about after the screening. I apologize for borrowing his quote here. But it's built around cheer points. It feels like the movie that's, every 5 minutes it wants you to cheer, and does that by every 5 minutes. It's another monologue about how important Mexican Americans are. And I don't want to undermine their point. I think this movie was made with best, but that's a good intention for a movie, is to celebrate that. I just don't think it's a good movie, and I think that it's a really weak script, and it just does not. It does not trust its message to come across in a way naturally. It effectively has to tell us constantly, and I found it really annoying after the first 30 minutes when there's another hour left.
Yeah, that's a bummer. So that's Flamin' Hot. That's going to be on Hulu, I think. That's a Hulu original, if I'm remembering correctly. Okay, the last one that you saw is a movie or a TV show called Join or Die?
This is a movie. It's a documentary. Ryan Scott reviewed it for Slash Film. It should be on the site now. And I'll be brief here, because I did like it. It's a documentary about the concept of... is democracy in America dying because we don't join clubs? And it follows a guy who's spent his entire career as a political scientist, first in Italy and then the United States, exploring about how when Italy revised its government to be like essentially state-based, he discovered that the states in Italy that have the strongest democracies or the local governments that were most trusted were the states in Italy that had consistently influential or well-attended choir groups and church groups. Then he brought the data to America and found out that as people have lost faith in government, as democracies come under attack, as things start falling apart, coincides directly with the fall of bowling leagues, with the fall of people joining the Elks, with the fall of like League of Women Voters being a thing, with knitting circles falling apart. And his hypothesis, which was a documentary it was all about, is that as communities fall apart and people stop being forced to like spend their day-to-day alongside people they disagree with while sharing something they love, people stop trusting each other and democracy fails, which is a wild thesis, but one I think the documentary paints in a pretty fascinating fashion. I'm not saying 100% convinced by it, but I'm simply saying that I left the movie going, maybe I should join a club. Maybe I should join an organization in my local town just to try to save democracy. So
my gut reaction to that, Jacob, is like the idea that things are falling apart and people aren't joining these clubs or whatever means that they have more time to be online and be radicalized. Is that thread brought up at all in the movie?
Yeah, it's touched on about how people on the internet, you know, if you're in a bowling league and you're with a guy, if you're on a bowling team with a guy who drives you nuts, but you got to bowl with him, you know, you learn to be respectful of that person. Buffs the guy on Facebook, you call him an asshole. So, right. So that's kind of the movie's thesis, is that it's a social currency. The United States is dead. The idea of somebody you disagree with trusting you and liking you because you're in the same bowling league. And therefore, like, if you say, hey, help me out here, or hey, I think you're wrong about that, instead of trusting them and to like have the conversation, instead you yell at each other. And I thought that was it made me go, oh yeah.
So, okay, yeah. So that's join or die.
I don't think it hasn't released yet, but I feel like the kind of doc that I can imagine popping up on Hulu or Amazon at some point. But I would recommend keeping an eye out for it if you want to have a good reason to maybe look in your local bowling league.
Okay. All right. Yeah, there's a good recommendation. All right. I think that's going to do it for today's show. Jacob, do you have more lined up in the closing days of South by Southwest? What else are you looking forward to seeing, if anything? Oh,
I learned yesterday that going out to a film festival while recovering from a car accident is not something you should do. So I'm probably done at South by for the time being. Except for the closing night screening of Air, the Ben Affleck movie, which we'll be covered on Slash Film. The question now is just whether or not I will be able to make it out there myself. But look for our review of Air on Saturday or Sunday after that screening.
Okay. And yeah, and we have a ton of reviews from South by Southwest up on slashfilm.com. Several articles that were written by Jacob himself. So I encourage you all to go to Slash Film and check those out. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Google, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. Please subscribe to our newsletter, send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at peter@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends, spread the word. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you on Monday.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.